Friends, this episode of the DTFH is brought to you by the sacred HTML Kabbalists over at squarespace.com. It's time for you to make a website so beautiful it causes the gods to weep ecstatic tears of joy that land on planet Earth and bring an eternal period of peace to our people. All you got to do is go to squarespace.com, use offer code Duncan, and you'll get 10% off your order of a new website or a domain name. Squarespace.com. Hello, dear friends. It is I, D. Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. For those of you who may not be familiar with who I am because you've tuned in for the Will Oldham interview, I am a 64-year-old lesbian botanist living in New Zealand. Sorry about that, you guys. I was at a party and some asshole spilled ketamine on my computer, and ever since then it's been assuming the identities of random people on the planet, or assuming the universal identity, or quoting Krishnamurti.
But to find out who you are, not who the speaker is far more important. And to find out who you are, you have to inquire. You are the story of mankind.
Oh, I'm going to have to take this to the Apple store. It just keeps pumping out Theosophist messiahs and little Alan Watts clips, and it's just the whole thing is
warping in and out of the frames of the universe.
So I just want to get this great episode up with Will Oldham.
I grow old. I shall wear the bottoms of my trousers rolled.
Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I shall wear white flannel trousers and walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids singing each to each. I do not think that they will sing to me. I have seen them riding seaward on the waves, combing the white hair of the waves blown back.
When the wind blows the water white and black, we have lingered in the chambers of the sea,
by sea girls wreathed with seaweed red and brown,
till human voices wake us and we drown.
And wake.
All right, I gotta take this to the Apple store. Boom! Got it fixed. Sorry about that, you guys. As it turns out, the ketamine had gotten into the motherboard and summoned some kind of interdimensional caterpillar family that had built a chapel inside my computer, and they had been singing hymns to the universal truth that we are all one beautiful orgasmic consciousness unfolding into time, and it was fucking with my memory chips. Not a technical guy. I'm not going to pretend that I understand even what that means, but we are back. We're going to jump right into this episode with Will Oldham, but first, some quick business. This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by Squarespace.com. It's time for you to stop staring at the pulsating demon hearts you've been wrenching out of the chest cavities of the ghouls and goblins you keep finding digging around in the familial graveyard behind your manor house, and start selling those things online. Everybody wants creamed demon hearts right now, because the cream of a demon heart will make your cock harder than the iron staff of a weather wizard living in a tropical forest in mid-July. You want that throbbing phallus, and if you don't happen to be phalloused, then you probably would like your lover's phallus to be throbbing, or a friend's phallus to be throbbing. We want more throbbing phalluses, and Squarespace is where you can go to start your throbbing phallus business. All you got to do is go to squarespace.com, use offer code Duncan, and you will get 10% off a website that will be so incredibly amazing, because you can assemble it using beautiful templates created by world-class designers. They've got powerful e-commerce functionality. It lets you sell anything online. You could easily customize look and feel, settings, products, and more with just a few clicks. Everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. You can buy domains and choose from over 200 extensions. They've got 24/7 award-winning customer support. Also, many of you are aware of the superstition of certain indigenous cultures who refuse to allow their picture to be taken because they think it'll steal their soul. We all know this is a bunch of hogwash, but if you truly want to sell or steal your friend's soul, the best way to do it is to buy their domain name. So if your friend doesn't have a domain name yet in their name, you can capture that domain name. Do you realize the potency? Get a domain name in your grandmother's name and then put a bunch of foot fetish porn on there and send it to your mom. What could be a more fun way to spend a rainy Sunday than that? Squarespace.com. Head over there, use offer code Duncan. You will get 10% off. It doesn't just have to be a business. You can just build a website for the sake of pure chaos. And Squarespace is the place you can go to start. Squarespace.com. Head over there right now. Use offer code Duncan and you will get 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. You can start a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, then you can buy the website. So you don't even need a credit card. You can just see if it works for you. But the proof is in the pudding, my sweet darlings. Head over to DuncanTrussell.com and you will witness the power of Squarespace, because that website was made using Squarespace. Squarespace.com. Offer code Duncan. You will get 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. Thank you, Squarespace. Pals, if you're sick of my raspy, seemingly lesbian voice assaulting the inner sanctum of your inner ear with my ridiculous, ponderous, chaotic, and oftentimes completely confusing, unprofessional opening rants, do you no longer want to suffer under the cruel burden of having to listen to commercials? Would you like early access to interviews? There's a way you can do that, while simultaneously supporting what has been called by President George W. Bush America's favorite podcast, the DTFH. All you got to do is go to patreon.com/DTFH and subscribe for a mere $5 a month, less than you would pay to buy a craft beer at your local bar establishment. You will get early access to interviews such as the one that's sitting over at Patreon right now with Wayne Coyne from the Flaming Lips. You'll also get access to long, confusing, didactic monologues that I'm too embarrassed or afraid to put on the main feed. You can also listen to some of the synthesizer music that I'm learning to create. But most importantly, you will be watering the sacred garden of the DTFH, and you will become a patron, a master. You will become my master. You will have to flog me when I'm disobedient. You'll have to spank me. You'll have to show me what it means to submit to your power. You'll ask me to bring you quiche and to climb to the top of a mountain, pluck the feather from a mythical eagle creature that I'll bring to you. And when I bring it to you, you'll grab my head and force it into your hot loins and make me pleasure you for hours and hours and hours. Head on over to patreon.com/DTFH. You can also support the DTFH by going through our Amazon link. And friends, if you want to really crater your life, if you want to send a lightning bolt of chaos into the heart of your life, then go to Amazon and order a Make Noise Morphogene. It's a modular synth. You're going to have to get what's called a Euro rack to go with it. But if you want to have the most psychedelic audio toy that I've ever seen in my life, then that's the thing for you, a Morphogene. I'm so sucked into the world of modular synths, and I would like you to be too. But first, just go through the Amazon link located at DuncanTrussell.com. Whenever you do that, anything you buy on Amazon, they give us a very small percentage of, and it costs you nothing. We also have a shop with t-shirts and posters and stickers. Check it out. All right, that's it, friends. Let's do this podcast. Today's guest is a musical hero of mine. I connected with him when I was going across the country in a recent road trip, and he was kind enough to let me stay at his beautiful home in Louisville and to let me conduct this interview with him. Not only did I get to eat dinner with one of my musical heroes, I also got to play video games with him and his wonderful wife, Elsa. If you have the karmic misfortune of having never listened to Will Oldham or Bonnie Prince Billy, as he's called, you should immediately take all your clothes off, draw yourself a bath, light some lavender candles, and listen to Master and Everyone. And your life will be eternally blessed, and you will realize that this planet that we are currently inhabiting is a sacred and glorious place. So without further ado, spread those heart chakras wide and send as much sweet love goo zinging through the interstellar quantum stuff that connects all of us so that it splatters all over the face and chest of the beautiful, delightful, and genius Will Oldham. Hey, Will, thanks so much for being on the show, man.
Thanks for having me. When you were just testing the microphones, you had the little tuk-tuk-tuk.
Metronome. Tuk.
Yeah, metronome. Is that going on right now?
No, the metronome's off.
I'm not going to encourage you to do this right now, but I would say you should do a test conversation / interview sometime with the metronome going.
Good idea.
Like as a beat, so that people are like...
Know the pace of the conversation.
Know the pace of the conversation, but it adds, you know, adds a kind of an urgency to it, potentially. Because we'd had a fantasy, it was, you know, one of many unrealized ideas, but years ago, I approached Greg Turkington asking him to provide me with live audio for a Neil Hamburger set.
Yeah, sure.
With the idea that we would remix it, cut out most of the pauses, and give it a beat. So that the experience, you'd be listening to a comedy record or a comedy recording, but it'd be like, boom, boom, boom.
Great
boom.
Idea.
But with the jokes in there and no pauses between the jokes necessarily, just like, go, go, go. Yeah, but we never did it.
Why?
Just before you pushed record, I don't know my gear very well. So...
Oh, yeah. So let's...
I would need a partner, a good partner with that.
I want to talk... So I was... Right before we hit record, I was trying to open up to Will by saying...
Audiophile. You're an audiophile.
No, before that, I said, man, I'm a little nervous to do this interview because... And just so we get this out of the way, and then we'll dive into the real conversation. But got to get out of the way. I'm so sorry to say it. Uh-huh. But as I'm sitting like, God damn, I'm going to talk with Will Oldham. What's the first question for Will Oldham? And I just kept thinking, like, well, everybody must come up to you and say to you, we have wept during your music has been the soundtrack for me personally.
Weeping.
For breakups and getting back togethers. Oh. And, you know, like the sweetness of life and the stuff, and your voice is there sort of, like shining this light into these moments that all of us are having. And so, I'm sorry. I just had to get that out of the way.
I have no idea what happens on the other side. So it's good to hear it, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, or does it get annoying? I don't know. Does it become overwhelming to hear these like drooling people are like, my God,
it really doesn't happen that often because our existence is relatively, I don't know. People. Yeah. Every once in a while, people will send a nice letter or something like that, and then I get some kind of an understanding. And otherwise, it's kind of based on trust because it's been going on. Making the music has been going on for such a long time, and I'm allowed to continue to make music because people are, you know, receiving it and trading in what I like to think is hard-earned money for it. That makes me think like, oh, well, if people don't want me to make any more music, they just have to stop.
Right.
Yeah. But so as soon as money comes in and think, oh, okay, good, I can make
more
another
music.
Record. And just, but other than that, I have no idea what it's, I know what I'm making it for, but I don't know if people are using it for that. So it's good to hear that people
cool. are. Cool. That's great. Because why even think about that, right? There's getting caught up in that side of the thing could possibly disrupt the flow.
It could possibly disrupt, well... Because, because it's also so vast and different, right? Because every listening experience is bound to be fairly unique.
Oh, yeah.
Even though you were sort of saying, like, all these people or these experiences, but everyone is, specific and unique from every other one.
It'd be impossible. So I'm listening to your music as I'm falling in love with a girl. somebody else is listening to your music is they're like butchering a pig in some basement somewhere. Who knows? There's no way to tell what cracks and crevices and crannies it's soaking into throughout the world.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I was thinking the other day, and maybe I think this every 5 years or so, about trying to be a little more proactive with that and, you know, writing a song that's specifically saying, oh, I'm going to write a song specifically about this place or this activity, knowing that people will then, you know, tag it and listen to it in that when they're on the road trip to, you know, wherever, you know, Wichita, we're going to Wichita.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, let's put that Wichita song. Where's the Wichita playlist?
That's awesome.
But I don't know if I'll ever do that.
Please do that. Yeah. That's a hilarious theme album anyway. Just a bunch of
icing
experiences.
A cake. What's that cake icing song?
Taking a bath. That's a classic.
Taking a bath is a good one. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, when you're taking a bath, what's the song? Splish Splash.
Right? Every time.
Because is there another one?
No. That's
There's Ernie's Rubber Ducky.
Splish Splash, Ernie's Rubber Ducky, and Les Miserables is a classic bathtub.
There's a bath song.
No, just the whole thing is like if you're gonna like lay in the if you're gonna take a bath, listen to Les Miserables.
Oh,
lights
never done
and
that.
Candles. Oh, you got to try it. It's
yeah,
perfect.
But that's
for
not
bath.
Something that people go for, right? It doesn't have bath lyrics in it, does it?
No.
Yeah, so I'm talking about bath lyrics.
I know. I mean, that's like being in the sewers with like holding a child's body, which is kind of a bath in
kind of
satanic way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
speaking of child's body, both of these dogs are sitting here with me. This one is sitting up because she just ate, and she has a condition called mega esophagus, where her esophagus has no like musculature or definition. Huh. So every time she eats, she has to sit up for about 10 to 15 minutes because the esophagus isn't pushing the food into her stomach. So gravity is doing it.
Yeah. Is this the thing you have to do with her? You
have to do it with her, yeah.
Every time?
Otherwise, the food's... Like, if she... Like, now it's about time that she can get down and she can do whatever she wants. But, you know, the food otherwise would just sort of sit here in her... What should be her esophagus, and it won't move down. Eventually, she'll have problems breathing. She'll start coughing, and she'll just cough it up undigested. She may inhale some of that, gets into her lungs, and because the doctor's like, oh, yeah, they die of... pneumonia. At some point, they will die of pneumonia because that's just what happens to these dogs.
Does she know that she has to sit in your lap?
No, she's pretty good. She's pretty good about it. She doesn't get too fidgety.
And when you got this, sweetie, you guys, if you could see these dogs, they truly are. If a sunbeam fell out of heaven and turned into dogs, that's what you got. These are real gold standard pups here. But did you know that was a condition when you picked up the dog?
Because I don't think she had, like, so there was a woman who was sort of took care of my mom for 4 or 5 years, and she at one point about 4 years ago, almost 4 years ago, said, I've got, you know, my dogs are giving or having a litter, and I'm going to give you one of the puppies. And didn't ask me if I wanted a puppy, but just said, I'm going to give you one, and gave me this one. And then she kept that one and got rid of the rest of the litter, gave them away. And then last summer, she died. She died last summer. So we started taking this one just for play dates for the weekend from the widower. And then eventually she moved in with us. And then I think she developed the mega esophagus because she started every time she ate, she sort of ballooned. We didn't know, suddenly ballooned. And then she started just, regurgitating her food fully. We took her in, and the reason that she ballooned was because she kept trying to work the food down by swallowing, and she would just swallow air. So she was ballooned with gas. So she was like a little balloon, literally like a little balloon. And then they x-rayed her and showed just like that there was no formal esophagus existing in her.
Man, that's a really intense service to do for a little being is every day.
But it's such a strange thing because she's normal otherwise. She's not in pain.
Yes.
So you can't really justify putting her down.
Some people would,
yeah.
Instantly. They'd be like, oh, that's just poison her.
And you can't also pawn her off on somebody because you're saying like, You want to, every time this dog, you know, watch, be sure this that you know every time this dog eats and when it eats, when she eats, you hold her up. Or put her, we put her in a backpack, and she's also got a little wooden chair called a Bailey chair, which some folks make for dogs with mega esophagus, which is a badass name for a condition.
Yeah, for a second, I honestly thought you were just no. Like making
mega esophagus. Yeah,
man. You know, when stuff like that happens, where you end up in a kind of karmic obligation to a being.
Yeah.
Do you ever fantasize about reincarnation and that in some previous incarnation, the little puppy helped you and you made a deal? Oh.
No, not so specifically, but yeah, that makes, yeah. I mean, that's what the understanding of karma, the best it can be, right, is that you are imagining that it's related to something that's happened before or will happen after.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
But never specifically. I don't think specifically.
Well, it's like this idea of like the sort of way we're all this continuum of energy. And so from the perspective of millennia, we have all been everyone's mother. We've all been everyone's baby. We've all been everyone's friend.
Yeah.
And so you're always trading places. And so here is this little being.
Yeah.
The most innocent, helpless of creatures.
Yeah.
And you have now a lifetime deal with this being. You're every time this puppy eats twice a day.
Yeah.
You are going to cradle this dog so the dog can digest food
or throw her in her Bailey chair, yeah, or put her on your backpack in a backpack, yeah. Yeah, exactly, but you have to be witness. I always thought like I never wanted a pet in my adult life because I always thought I don't want to have to be a witness to every time this creature takes a shit. To me, that's always just seemed like a bizarre relationship to have. Like,
yes.
You have to be aware of every time you're like taking a creature into your life, and with a dog specifically, more so than the cat, because they just hide in litter boxes or whatever. But with a dog, you have to be kind of, especially like in New York City.
Absolutely.
Every single shit that the dog takes, you're a part of.
That's right.
And to me, I just thought, I'm not sure if that's not the kind of relationship that I want to have with any living creature.
No, the shape, the color. The consistency.
You witness it. Yeah. You participate in it.
Yeah. You pick it up.
Yeah.
I know the warmth of my dog's shit because I have these little bags I carry around. So I know the specific heat of my dog's shit.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
yeah, exactly. You know, yeah. Jeez. Yeah.
You know them at that most intimate level. I mean, the relationship, of course, mirrors that of having a child. When you have an infant, you know your child's shits very well.
Right.
You have to be familiar with them so you know if the baby's okay.
But it doesn't progress or develop. The most you can hope for is an inner progression or development in terms of your relationship to that, but it doesn't, you're never going, it's the dog's never going to take care of its own.
Never.
I mean, these dogs kind of can because we're not in New York City. We have a fenced in yard. They can go out and, you know, I am aware usually when they, and Gigi doesn't, she's more fond of not shitting in her own yard. Also, so we're a little bit aware of that, but in the city you really it's always going to be there.
I've got a little backyard, thank God.
So oh, you
I
do
can open up the door
in the
and
city
they run down. Yes, I oh, do cool. So that's they nice. Run down and shit.
Yeah, but you're still aware of it though, right? Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I know,
do it. Yeah,
well, exactly, because I have to make sure they go shit, because if they don't, they'll shit in the house. So I have to like sometimes usher them down there. But yeah, you're the conductor of your dog shit. You have to be the thing behind it, and that's a heavy obligation because sometimes you don't feel like it. I mean, there's got to be days you don't feel like massaging, like sitting. I don't know. These are cuties, but sometimes you're in a hurry or something, you know?
It's in a very strange way. Yeah. You would think that, but in a strange way, it almost doesn't enter into the equation. Like there's a niggling little thought that says that there's resentment about what's required of, you know, by these pups.
Yes.
But it's just like a lightning bug 40 feet away. It's not it's not a strong signal that, you know, and you would think this is fucking ridiculous. This is so, but instead it's like, oh, well, you know, it balances out. Like my life is pretty good with these things. And so it just balances out.
Yeah. And this is, there's this idea that. And, you know, whenever anyone assigns some purpose to humanity or says, this is what people are here for, it's usually pretty ridiculous and maybe a dangerous thought. Mm-hmm. But one of the ideas I've heard is the purpose of a human being is to serve. Have you ever heard that before? Like, our purpose here is to serve in some way.
I think that's on Muhammad Ali's grave.
Really?
Yeah. Which is just like a mile from here. You all can check it out on your way out if you want to. But yeah, it's something about, you know, that's it. That's the purpose.
That's the purpose. And this is like the Hare Krishnas talk about this, which is, so because humans are meant, so their idea is that the purpose is for us to be servants of God. Mm-hmm. And but people are amnesic to that purpose. So what ends up happening is they sort of become servants of all these other things because they're like robots that are fulfilling some kind of primary directive, but they have lost track of the thing they were originally supposed to connect with. So they're connecting with the thing in these sort of diluted forms. You know, everything is an expansion of the original, you know, progenitive force. So when you're like taking care of the puppy, you are worshiping God. But their idea is that this can be refined and sort of shifted to some kind of absolute source.
But is there a group of people who are aware that we assign ourselves our roles by figuring out, like, if you respond to that, do you respond to that?
Yeah, I get a little confused by it because it's like, well, seems like a little cute little puppy is definitely more of the kind of God I'd be into hanging out with than mm-hmm. the iconography that you see in different religions.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. But I mean, respond, like, if you recognize, if that pushes your button, that statement.
Yes.
Right? Then that just means that is your role. But it isn't necessarily somebody else's role.
Right.
If they don't recognize that statement and the truth of that statement, then it's not their job.
That's right.
So it's kind of, if you recognize it and it pushes your buttons, you think, shit,
gotcha. Shit,
you know, I guess it's my job to serve.
Because
it makes sense to me. I understand. I like doing dishes. Yeah. You know? I like doing dishes.
Me too.
You know, like we got rid of the dishwasher and put shelves where the dog food's here, but I also like doing dishes at other people's house.
Me too. Highest
job. Stupid, you know, but it's just like, but I know, you know, I have friends and relatives who do not feel that. And you can't, that's not it, right? That's,
you can't.
It's not their
not
job.
Tell
it's not their,
someone
but
to,
it's not their job.
Well, this is
it's your job to do the dishes. It's my job to do the dishes, but it's not.
Because we have the calling.
Yeah, we have the calling.
and you know what's so funny about it, man, is like, and I don't know, I don't mean to keep bringing up the Hare Krishnas, but it's one of the highest jobs at a Hare Krishna temple is to do the dishes.
Right.
So if you get to do the dishes, that's like a really big deal to get to do that. And so like when you're doing the dishes in a Hare Krishna temple, which I got to, not for any, as a mark of anything, my brother was hanging out there. And he's like, come feel this. And when you're doing the dishes back there, holy shit, you get high as a kite.
Right.
On nothing.
Yeah.
You've had that experience, that kind of mysterious intoxication that comes from some spiritual act.
Absolutely. I mean, we went on Saturday night. We went to a house show at our friend's house, and she usually combines an early evening potluck with the house shows, and she did. And at a certain point between acts, between musicians, I went in and was doing the dishes, you know. I also knew we were going to leave early. We don't, like, go for the late night hang usually. And at some point, she came in and talked to me for a minute, and I had this fear, where that she was going to stop me, you know, or say, you don't have to do that.
Yeah.
And she never once did. She just carried on a great conversation. She seemed very happy. And then she walked away. And I felt so great. I was just like, finally, I got to just do my job.
Yes.
And nobody bothered me about it. Nobody said, good work, or you don't have, nobody said anything about it. Just let me do my job.
Yeah.
And I knew that she was happy that I was doing it, though, because it was her kitchen and it was a mess.
Yep.
But yeah, it was like and
that
felt
relationship.
So nice.
Yeah, and that is such sophistication, because that relationship is so forgotten in our world, which is, so you're at your house, you serve some meal, and people, some saint goes and starts washing your dishes.
Yeah.
And then you want to be like, no, 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 no. There's a big show you put on. It's very similar to pulling your wallet out to pay. It's like this, no, 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 no. Don't you touch one of those dishes.
Yeah.
Get out of here. I'll do it.
Yeah.
And it's, and the moment you allow the flow to happen.
Anyone who puts their hands in a sink full of dirty dishes wants to do it for the most part, you know.
Yeah.
In somebody else's house.
Absolutely.
Especially. I'm not talking, yeah, not somebody who is forced to do it. But anybody who just voluntarily walks up and sticks their hand in there, let them go.
Yes. And that, so you it's like giving and receiving. Like, it's easier to give than it is to receive quite often. And so the gift of getting your dishes done by someone, you have to be able to receive it. And if you don't receive it, you not only do you cut off this beautiful energetic flow that's happening in the universe, but it's like taking a cupcake out of somebody's hand or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, which is ridiculous. It's and this is where everyone gets confused about the fact that work is quite satisfying and a really beautiful in all forms. Yeah. Yeah, you know, so yeah, but yeah, you're right. You can't then be like, hey, you know, if you were really advanced, you would love to do dishes because now you're the biggest cunt that ever walked the.
No. Again, you know, different. Yeah, fortunately, different people have different callings.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, this
and
is
unfortunately I'm called to oversee a dog with mega esophagus and to do people's dishes.
Yeah.
You know, I would, if I had to choose, maybe I would, if some, you know, if God said, here's 20 callings, pick some, I might not have picked either one of those. But
no.
They feel great.
You pick
having them, they're great.
You pick music.
Well, that, I mean, music in the same way, music kind of feels like it picked. It was a certain point where you recognize there are things that you can't do something else. And if you don't do the thing that you can do, then you don't have any, you'll be lost.
Right.
Yeah.
And I've heard pretty stern warnings about this before. Not only will you, like, the warnings are, should you be called to some, whatever the thing may be.
Yeah.
And you avoid that job.
Yeah.
Not only will you be lost, but it'll kill you.
Like look at Jim Carrey.
What's that?
I said, look at Jim Carrey.
What do you mean?
He's not doing what he's called to do, and he's insane.
You mean the thing he's doing with this nihilism thing that he's?
What is he doing now with nihilism?
He is
I've seen him do paintings.
He's doing paintings, but also he's sort of so everyone is, and I have been getting people like, you should have him on your podcast because he's gone into this kind of Mayavadi style. So have you heard the term Mayavadi?
No.
So I think it's called Mayavadi. So essentially the idea is, okay, the God presents God's self in many different ways. One of them is the personified form,
mm-hmm.
mega esophagus dog.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's
not personified though, but yeah.
I think it's personified. This is
it's dogified.
Yes. God dogifies.
And there is a difference. Like, it, you know, I don't believe that all living things are the same thing or all
right.
consciousnesses are the same. Yeah.
So, certainly a difference. Yeah. Yes. But so also another way God's self is presented is emptiness. And so all these different spiritual paths about engaging, absorbing, merging with these various forms of the divine, right?
Yeah.
So Mayavadi, I think, as I recall, and I could be using the wrong term, it might be a different term. Regardless, guys.
Yes.
This dog, I don't know about this dog. Gatsby, are you seriously doing this? It's a big chat here. So the idea is like people who are into impersonalism is another word for it. Impersonalism.
Mm-hmm.
There is no self. There ultimately everything is just a kind of continuum of nothingness. We're all producing a form, a personality. We're clinging. We're attached to the concept of the I. The reality of the situation is that there is this I that we are, but it's a very temporary thing. If we begin to really merge into the whole, then we become a kind of nothingness. So Jim Carrey has become, seems to have in some way or another connected with this concept in a pretty intense way. And now he is broadcasting this out. Yeah. So there's a picture of him in front of, he just tweeted a picture of him in front of one of his paintings saying, if you see me in the painting, something like, I am not in the painting. You, if you see me, I am not there. The painting is not there.
It's and is it a photorealistic self-portrait? That would be amazing.
It splatters of paint. It splatters of paint, you know? Yeah. So you think that Jim Carrey's job is to do comedy. He's gotten called into painting, and now he's like spiraling.
Or he hasn't gotten called into painting.
Oh, he's imagining that
he's imagining that he got called into painting.
Okay, let's talk about that. Because you have presented a rather severe, if we follow this, what you're saying, it's pretty spooky. Because you're saying, okay, let's say for imagine. I mean,
although he never, to me, he never felt like he was comfortable doing comedy. So maybe this is his true calling, actually.
Right.
And I always thought that he seemed like an uncomfortable presence when he was doing, you know, it alienated me somewhat as an audience member. So maybe it was always a bridge to what he's doing now.
Right.
Like this is the pure thing that he always wanted to, painting, needed to do. Or this just having a platform for an expression.
To be some kind of teacher.
To be some, yeah, just some expressor, or maybe things that he just felt needed to be said his entire life. You know, from when he was in the womb, he was waiting to amplify some thought or some feeling or something like that. Now finally he got.
Wait until I there. Tell him I'm nothing.
Yeah. Wait until I tell him I'm nothing. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because what you're saying is like, it makes me a little nervous because boy, do I waver. I'm like I love this moment. I love like these conversations are my favorite thing, but then it's like, shit, I love turning knobs on a modular synthesizer, but I certainly don't want to like, if the idea is we have some central calling.
Yeah.
And if we do some other thing, then we risk our sanity. Then it could create a bit of a superstitious Paul over experiments and creativity, right?
Well, also, if you understand that, or, you know, if you understand that you have, in order to function with other people, you know, there's your internal thing and then your external thing. In order to function with other people, your like, I understand that in order to function, I have to do what I do. But for a variety, it's not just because, you know, because you look around and you think, well, how can I participate in society? Well, this is ultimately the only way that I can participate in society. You know, how would I be most happy? Maybe laying in bed for years on end,
right,
you know, just in a really comfortable bed, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Where are you happy? Like that, yeah.
Yeah.
And then getting up and jumping in the ocean for a couple of days, and then getting, you know, and never coming up because you have gills.
Yes.
That's where I would be happiest, I think.
Yeah. Like a napping fish.
Like a napping fish, exactly. But you'd get bed sores, and then you would drown, and all these things, that's impossible. So what, yeah. So not, seems like Jim Carrey is following what he might consider his true bliss, but maybe it's his real.
I got you.
His real thing, but yeah, at a certain point that you can't actually be what you think you want to be.
Ooh, this is good. We have to be able to discern laying in bed at versus like or the kind of indulging our sort of, I don't know what you would call it, lower modes of existence from our true calling. And it, sometimes that can get really foggy,
yeah.
I think, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's really weird, man. That's a tough one, man. Like, how do you...
Like, if you can't surf for a living, you can't surf for a living. Some people can surf for a living.
Gotcha.
Some people can surf for their spiritual living, right? But they're going to have to get a job because they're not getting paid to do that.
You're not getting paid to surf.
Some people are getting paid to surf.
I'll never get paid. Like, if I start right now, I'll never be a professional surfer. And if suddenly I decided that that's what I was and went to Hawaii and started surfing, it's insanity. People are like, yeah, you've lost your mind. You're not going to.
Or like that I know, you know, I know I could, you know, if I thought about it for a minute or less, I could come up with 10 people that I know who are purely on a kind of a musical creative level, like born to make music.
Yes.
Much more than I'm born to make music.
I'm one of those people probably.
To make music.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. But I'm like, my brain works to come up with, you know, to make music and build it and get it to you.
Yeah.
Where somebody else, there's some people who I think they have this resentment because they know how great they are.
Yeah. Hold on. Let me pause it for 2 seconds. Hey!
So somebody may have a resentment that they know that they're a great musician.
Yes.
Right? And they have a resentment because they know that they're better than almost anybody that they've ever come into contact with.
Yes.
They know. They just know.
Right.
And they're right.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But they're not good at any other part of what it requires to get music from one person to another person.
Yes.
They're terrible at that.
Yes.
And I am better at that than some musicians who are better than me, which is why I like to collaborate a lot, because I can work with people who aren't as good getting their awesomeness.
Gotcha.
And it's like, oh, well, I can help you get your awesomeness if you'll hang out with me for a day or two.
Wow.
You know?
Cool.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I gotcha. Yeah, that's really interesting. That's cool, man. But you wouldn't place yourself in that top 10 list? You know, you don't see yourself born to make music?
No, I think I'm born to, like, listen to music. I would much rather listen to music. If somebody just said, here's a pile of, you know, never-ending money, and, you know, music helps me because I'm not a social person, you know.
Right.
It helps me helps me get out of my house.
Yes.
And interact with people and have conversations with people and recalibrate my brain. But I love listening to music. I love listening to people play music. I love listening to records. I love it so much. It's so satisfying. And it's works, you know, sometimes you're the way that music can be exciting feels like you're kind of accomplishing something at its best.
Mm.
When you have a great musical experience with somebody else making the music.
Yes.
It feels as if you've accomplished something.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that would be my indulgent, you know, urge would just to do that, but I understand that I would become something that could, you know, undeniably be called insane, right?
Just the guy who's like listens to music all the time.
Yeah, because also you can't. Well, because if I wasn't, you know, take into consideration that making the music also keeps me interacting with people.
Yes,
right.
Gotcha.
So if it didn't, I would just did you see the Rocky Erickson documentary?
No, I haven't seen it, but I obviously know about Rocky Erickson.
And there's a scene in it where they visit him in his room, and he's got like 2 or 3 radios playing different channels, a couple of TVs playing different channels, and that's kind of what he needs for his brain to be quiet.
Yeah,
you know, and I understand that. That makes sense.
Yeah, sure.
But instead, you could also, the signals could be coming from other people, and that's
gotcha.
Great. You know, that can help quiet your brain.
Yeah.
Because your brain can just go to the weirdest places without checking in with somebody else.
Sure.
Yeah. So then thinking, oh, well, I know now that all this music exists and I love it and I want to exist, you know, I want to participate with other people, I want to be a fully realized human being as much as possible for the time here that I have.
Yes.
So I have to learn to make some of this music. I wouldn't have made it in the first place,
right.
But I have to learn to make it because that's like the toolbox that I've got, that I, you know.
Yes.
The music is powerful to me, so I have to try to figure out how to reproduce some of what I'm finding valuable in these things and then get it to other people.
Yeah, I gotcha, man. Yeah, it's a... So all of this music here is like ingredients that make up the tapestry.
All of this music here, but also just going to see music or talking about music, everything becomes an ingredient because it's also, it's about, you know, when you listen to a record, you think, well, you know, I like to listen to this Hawaiian record.
Yeah.
It's 50, 60-year-old record maybe. And thinking, you know, what was its life before this? Why did they make it? They didn't make it for me. Absolutely, they didn't make it for me. But it's mine now. But who did they make it for?
Yes.
And how can I then make a record for somebody knowing why they made this great record for somebody else?
Wow.
Right?
Cool, man. Yeah, that's cool. We were actually, forgive us, we were going through your stack here to see what you were listening to. And a lot of Hawaiian music in there.
Yeah, well, I just had pulled out because we're going soon, and so I'd pulled out a couple of records. There's a great, you know how people are kind of into small press vanity label things.
Yes,
there's a really, I hope it's still there because I haven't been there in a while. But there's a place called Jelly's in the west side of Honolulu that has some great used records, and there was a lot of music that was being made in Hawaii in the late '60s into the '70s that I'm kind of into. That's just local bands playing what was called, it was electrified, but it was called traditional Hawaiian because it was, you know, they're singing in Hawaiian. And a lot, you know, yeah,
I love it.
Hearing it. Yeah.
And this album you're playing, what is this specific album?
This is the Sons of Hawaii. So it's famous for, like its most famous member of this ensemble was Gabby Pahinui. You know, if is that name sound familiar?
No.
Oh, okay. He reminds me of, his story sort of reminds me of some friends of mine who are like musical forces where they are borderline non-functional human beings who are, you know, supernaturally skilled at creating music. And it seems from the way people, you know, it's hard to hear because it's Hawaiian music and it's taken a lot of work to to not hear it as Hawaiian music. You know what
right,
I mean?
Sure.
Because people will play this record and think, oh, I hate Hawaiian music. Or that's neat. That's Hawaiian
music.
No,
when you play it, all it does for me is I just think about like Hawaii, how pretty Hawaii is.
Exactly.
I'm just thinking about vacation. It makes me feel relaxed in a vacation-y kind of way.
And listening to a bunch of the records, then you start to understand, well, here's where the real shit is, or here's where the inspiration is. And then also reading about it and reading about the way people talk about Gabby and that he was this force that wasn't, you know, like you couldn't rely on him for anything.
Right.
You know, he would be late or not show up, would maybe take your money or would leave the band inside it, sign a solo deal, leaving everybody behind and not think twice about it.
Wow.
Not, you know, just maybe be mildly embarrassed about it, but not evil. Just not think twice. But these same people who are telling these stories say, but when he started playing, just didn't matter. It didn't matter.
Wow.
You know, it was just nothing but good feeling. You know,
yeah.
You were either inspired or super joyful or whatever. You were in the music as much as he was. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there are those kind of people.
Do you, because we've taught you, it's sort of come up here and there in our conversation. Do you worry that you might go insane a little bit? Like, because do you fear the pull of that potential for you, that you could be pulled out of like being able to, like you were saying, produce and get it out into the world and drawn into this kind of madness, this creative madness?
Yeah, I used to worry about it a lot until I started to understand that kind of, you know, the definition of insanity and the definition of reality and the way that they intersect. If you start your day understanding those two things, you're good.
Whoa.
And a lot of people just do, you know, again, you know, I'm jealous of the people who are like Gabby, you know, just kind of the music just comes out of them. It feels like it, or, you know, it just seems like they can't help but be what everybody else wants to be when they're trying to make music. And the same, you know, I'm jealous of people who just are just, you know, pretty darn functional.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And so that you realize, like, oh, it can take a lot of work. It's incredibly rewarding, but it takes a lot of work to be functional.
Yes.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Especially when you're in a life where you don't necessarily have to pull off the regular schedule that many people do.
Yeah.
When you have vast swaths of time that truly could be filled with nothingness, because I'm sure for you, you know, you have income streams coming in from all of your work. So if you wanted to, you could just sit back for a while, probably, right?
Yeah, you could. I mean, at this point, at this point in my life, I could sit back. For how long and what sort of atrophy would occur during that sitting back time, you know? So then that's kind of a beyond the motivation of how, I don't know, how nice it is to make music. That's super broad, but thinking if I stepped back, I would have to come to terms with the fact that that might be a permanent stepping back, either because some accident could befall you and you would never get to return, or you could miss, or technologically it could be as simple as that, right? This just the superficial, like if you step back enough and you try to step back in and people are like, yeah, I'm listening to, you know, all my music through this chip in my brain in my neck.
Yeah.
And you're just like, I have, what? I don't know. And I'm, you know, and you don't make music anymore. What if people don't make I don't make music anymore in 12 years.
Yeah.
Because people have this chip in, and the thing that they're listening to most of all are the artists that they're collaborating with. Because if I were a musical artist, I would create templates that would go in the chip, that would go in your neck. And you like the way that that you can steer those templates. Like, oh, I love, you know, the Katy Perry of 12 years from now because she has this lyric, and when I play it in my neck chip, it does this thing. It's amazing. I love it. I listen to it all the time.
Sounds so cool.
But if I took 12 years away, coming back, I'd just say, I have this little song. People would be like, what's the song? Well, I don't understand. Get it, you know?
Participate in this?
There was an interview with Lorde that I listened to, and, you know, she's young. They're like, what's your relationship with records? She said, oh, I've been in the room a couple times when people had a record player. And they were playing records on different speeds for fun.
Oh, my God.
And that's it. So you can see, you know, and yeah, just like a kid, you know, an inner city kid, you show him that a carrot came out of the ground. He's like, I'm not eating that.
Oh, my God.
That came out of the ground.
Yeah,
so you could say eventually like a song, people be like, a song? What is a song? That is weird. Oh, is that sort of like that thing that I get off my neck chip?
Oh, God. That's a Black Mirror. You did just write an episode. I'm not sure if you just wrote an episode of Black Mirror or if you just came up with one of the best inventions of all time, a sonic neck chip that will allow me to like harmonize in a way or rewrite lyrics.
Yeah, remix, rewrite, or the way that you were chopping things with that synthesizer. Yeah, chop something, but somebody delivers to you either the content or a specific algorithm or program And that's what you purchase when you purchase a musical thing, the algorithm or the content.
Who is the comedian? God, forgive me for not remembering this. Damn it. The comedian who released the album where it has the script of a team act and you can so he's just saying one side of the team act and you get to say the other side. He's like one of the great comedians of all time. And the fact I can't remember his name.
I feel like Neil Hamburger did that also. He did an interview record where it came with a script and you could do, but you could also just listen to, like the funny part was if you just listen to the interview without the,
That's right. I love questions. This.
Yeah.
This collaborative, it seems like you love collaboration.
Yeah.
And it seems like what you're mentioning here, outside of the dark dystopian future where you've taken 12 years off, you emerge from some place, long hair, wanting to sing. People are like, who are you? Was that some form of screaming? We don't know what this is.
Yeah.
But like, it seems like this idea that you have is really quite beautiful, which is you want to connect even more with the listeners in the sense of figuring out a way to let us make the music with you.
Well, except we shouldn't overestimate the average, you know, consumer slash listener's willingness, energy, time,
right,
ability to participate. You know, you have like the Brian Eno's and the Bjork's who've made apps that allow people to, you know, create music. But
yeah,
how much is that? They're not really, I don't think, you know, those are...
It's novelty.
It's novelty.
It's like Cracker Jack. It's a thing in a Cracker Jack box or something.
Yeah. But I imagine that there may be something that resembles less just the pushing play and the music happening. And maybe it isn't that we control it, but maybe it's that every time you play the Katy Perry song, it is actually a slightly different song. And the way that somebody's app, that's what you're consuming maybe. So maybe, you know, John X creates the greatest app for remixing or resequencing a song. So you listen to the, you know, the way that you were chopping and splicing Joni Mitchell,
yes,
last night, that if you might, there might be one day an artist that does what you're doing, but does it so well that people say, oh, I'm you know, I'm listening to Duncan Trussell right now. But they don't mean you. They mean they're listening to Bob Dylan, but through your filters and,
yeah,
and the way, but it's something that that's is potentially crazy, always changing.
Yeah, or you know what gets me really excited is the idea of remixing, like you're saying, but not from one individual, but from collectives. So instead of it just being like, oh, I'm listening to Bob Dylan through the filter of some person who's remixing or whatever, a community getting engaged in the remixing of things. Because like a band, except it's a whole group of people, a collaboration,
yeah,
of... all of it's beautiful because it's this merging together that you're talking about, this like non-ownership of the art and letting us like dive in and swim around a little bit inside of it. I think that's,
yeah,
exciting.
Except I mean, I'm more realistic in terms of, or you know, that is beautiful, kind of, but I'm not meaning it in a beautiful way. I'm meaning like that people are taking, you know, someone said, told me the other day that they had talked to someone. They said, what's your favorite music? Oh, I like, you know, to listen to Six Organs of Admittance. And what else? And what comes after that? Meaning that they're playing like Pandora.
Oh, shit.
And that's their favorite kind of music, is the music that comes after that.
Oh,
so
my God,
I'm not saying
so
that people
wild
aren't going to be active and participant in a beautiful way. It's just maybe a different way. The way that our musical taste now, if you listen to Pandora, it goes song, then another song, then another song.
Right.
But someone might do that within a song. Like there may eventually,
gotcha,
be a service that's just, you don't never have to leave that one song if you don't want to. I want to hear, you know, where a computer could remix a song for 40 minutes. So you don't,
God,
have to get a DJ to do it. And it's the same every time. But you could listen to R. Kelly sing Happy People for your 30-minute workout. And it's only a 8-minute song, but you can listen to it for 30 minutes because someone has worked out a way, and it's not
that's
the same the
most,
next day.
One
it's
of the most creepy, dire things I think I've ever heard any human utter. The idea that you could just, for a lifetime, some people, it's not like what kind of music do you listen to, it's what song do you listen to?
Yeah, what song do you listen to?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But I can also, I mean, there are some songs that are so intensely satisfying that I think, you know, oh, I kind of wouldn't mind
you,
like listening to this for 7 hours.
Can you name one
hours
off the top of your head?
Like the Don Everly's recording of Omaha, you know, from his first solo record, 1970.
Yeah. Never, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah.
Got to listen to that now, though.
Yeah, something like that. Or, you know, I love Barry Manilow's Could It Be Magic?
Oh.
You know that one?
No.
You don't know that?
No, listen, this is as I was saying before.
You don't
know? No, please, I stopped you from singing.
I'll play it after this.
Okay.
It's,
can you sing a tiny little piece of it?
Yeah, you know, it's what's the it's really dramatic and huge. It's Could It Be Magic? Now into my arms. This could be, you know, I don't know. I've known it since I was little. I think my dad put on a mixtape for road
trips. I got
trips
one like
stuff
that. You know, the one I love is Johnny Cash singing We Must Believe in Magic. You know that
one? Oh, well,
one?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
My God.
We must believe. Huh.
Yeah.
I don't know if I've heard him do that, but yeah.
Oh, it's so good. And who is that? Who sang it originally? I can't remember her name.
Yeah, it was, because it's also on, Johnny Cash, one of his good friends was the songwriter, producer, Cowboy Jack Clement, and it's also on his first solo record, which is one of the great records of all time. Because, you know, it begins about, it's about Alpha Centauri, yeah. Right? Yeah, hell yeah, yeah. Yeah.
That's oh, amazing. Yeah.
Yeah.
What is it? The captain
of Alpha Centauri. I'm the captain of Alpha Centauri.
Yeah. No, it's
something,
no,
something. We must be out of our minds or something.
Yeah, he talks about who's on the ship. It's dreamers and poets and clowns. And he yeah. throws in clowns. It, right. Like the dreamers and poets are cool, but then the ship gets kind of weird if like scattered throughout are clowns.
There's a... So there's a documentary about this guy, Cowboy Jack Clement, called, I think it's called Cowboy Jack Clement's Home Movies or Shakespeare Was a Big George Jones Fan. And it's kind of a stunning portrayal of the inner life of an artist where I think he would say that that's, you know, I don't know, it's like one of his theme songs, and he's perfectly happy with this idea of clowns being in there.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I mean,
and then he and Cash were very close and liked to be silly with each other.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
No, but that, I mean, but come on, that is an anthem to the occult.
Yeah. Who wrote that song though?
I think it's almost worth a Google search.
No, it's not. It's worth looking at the record shelf. Here, hold on.
Oh, yeah. Awesome. Right. Okay, cool. I'm going to hit pause. So we got that. We have the album.
And I think my first encounter with the song, I'm pretty sure, was on The Muppet Show. I think they must have done it at some point.
Wow.
But yeah, we have the record. It was written by, it's called We Must Believe in Magic, and it was written by Bob McDill and Alan Reynolds.
Wow.
And Bob McDill, do you know who Bob McDill
no.
is or was? He's a songwriter who's kind of, his biggest successes came... I like to think of him as the, you know, there's like the classic one is De Niro, Scorsese, right?
Yes.
Director, actor, one of them needs the they need each other.
Yes.
Right? And Bob McDill worked with a singer, Don Williams, who just died maybe a month or two ago.
Yeah.
And he was that was them. That was the, you know, the Cyrano relationship.
Gotcha.
Bob McDill wrote Don Williams' greatest songs. And neither would be who they are without the other person.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Really, really, really beautiful. Like, and it's really beautiful to think of it that way when you listen to Don Williams records because...
Yoo-hoo! Gatsby, stop!
But, and then Alan Reynolds is a... I think he's a professional, like his... The main way he makes his living is from writing songs and producing records.
Yes.
But he's also like tops in the world of Nashville backup singers.
Right.
But he's also I think he was one of the big creative guiding forces of the whole Garth Brooks thing. I think he produced all the Garth Brooks records that made Garth Brooks who we think of him
wow.
as today. So they wrote that song.
Man,
I think they're pals with Cowboy Jack Clement.
You have to be so lucky to find one of those people in your life. Like to be lucky enough to just pair up with somebody
yeah.
who's going to help you
yeah.
do that. That's just a miracle of the highest proportion.
Absolutely.
Man.
And I love seeing it. It's one of my favorite things to...
And being it, right?
To witness.
It feels like you're that a little bit for people.
Yeah, but with different people.
Right.
Yeah. As opposed to, it's not the single partnership. It's a lot of different partnerships.
Right. Yeah. Man... Do you, one thing that I wanted to ask, are you a little anti-technology to some degree? Are you nervous about technology a little bit?
I'm sometimes, well, maybe. Yeah, I think sometimes.
Because I wanted to Google search.
Oh, yeah.
We Must Believe in Magic. And you were like, no, let's just go physically.
Right.
Go to the record shop.
Because it's right there.
Right.
Yeah. I'm mainly anti people doing things that I think you're allowing somebody else to do things for you. You know, you're giving them the authority to do things for
yes.
you that really there's just not a reason you shouldn't be doing it for yourself because it's better for you. You can trust your own actions better than you can. Yeah,
Have you heard this term? That there's an anarchist term called de-skilled. Have you heard that?
Being I probably de-skilled. Have. Yeah, exactly. It seems like people are dying to be de-skilled.
Yeah.
Just dying to. Like, really,
they're dying
really,
because they're de-skilled.
Right. But people are just, love, you know, take it away from me. Take more power away from me. Take more ability away from me. I don't want to have to think. I don't want to have to do anything. Please, please, please do it all for me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's happening.
And it's weird. And I think life is less fun the more de-skilled I notice that I become. As well, the people that I spend time with are less, it's not as rewarding to spend time with people who are volunteering to give up their abilities and their authorities.
Right. Oh, and it's humiliating to find yourself suddenly in the presence of skilled people.
Right.
This happens to me. When I went to Burning Man this last year, I came in early because you build this camp. It's a lot of hard work.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah,
and the people I'm with, these are people who are skilled. They know how to do just about everything. They know how to build things. They know how to solder. They know how to make stuff.
Yeah.
And being around skilled people and suddenly realizing that you are de-skilled on a lot of different levels, it's like not being able to read. It's a real profound sense of like, man, how did I end up here? Where this, I don't know how to.
Yeah.
That's a pretty intense feeling, man.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that's the only way that I'm anti-technology, I think. When it's taking a shortcut to get someplace that the reason you wanted to get there in the first place is you forget that the reason that people wanted to get to that destination is because of the work that it took to get there.
Yes. Yeah.
And you think like, I have it now. I have it. It's like, yeah. You know, when someone's just like, I got pearls now. And it's like, well, the whole reason the pearls had value is because how hard it was to get them.
Wow.
It wasn't because someone sent you a credit card in the mail and then you went to the store and bought them. It was because they wear their pearls well because they worked their asses off to get the pearls.
Wow.
Right?
Yeah, man.
So when it's just like, oh, I can Google this and get the information, then the information is kind of worthless.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. You earn your wrinkles. You earn your... The idea is like, yeah, the thing... Yeah, I got you, man. You're right. And when you do finally achieve the thing, whatever it is, after some struggle, it's eternally more valuable. Definitely.
We did a... Like, it was... It was... It'll be 12 years ago this coming January. Did a tour in New Zealand. And during the rehearsal time... So this was just 12 years ago. And people were default Googling to further conversations and to decide arguments 12 years ago. That's kind of amazing, right? But we were in a place in where there was no cell phone signal and there was no wireless there or anything like that. So in order to make up for this de-skilling that had occurred, we took a piece of cooked spaghetti and called it the Google Spag. And whenever we had a question that, you know, we would say, oh, let's Google that answer, you would pick up the Google Spag and then you could say the answer. So you were Google, you know?
Awesome. So
if you said, what year did Abraham Lincoln die? I can't remember. You pick up the Google Spag and you can just say 1867 and then we move on with the conversation. And that's the new truth. Was it 1867? I have a feeling it wasn't. But, right?
Yes.
So you... But that's kind of because we're doing that, right? I'll pick up my computer, I will Google, and then I will tell you what the truth is.
Yeah.
Because what?
Who cares?
But also because what? What did you actually do, and who just told you what the truth is?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like I have a shellfish allergy. I look up glucosamine is a, you know, it's a supplement you could take that's good for your joints, supposedly.
Sure.
And it's made from shellfish most of the time. So I looked up to see, is glucosamine made with the compounds in shellfish that people who are allergic to shellfish are usually, you know, react to?
Yeah.
And you do, you know, I haven't done this in 6 or 7 years, but I looked it up, and on the first string of results, glucosamine is definitely produced from the compounds within shellfish that people are allergic to. If you're allergic to shellfish, avoid this.
Yes.
Next answer. Glucosamine is safe to consume for people who are allergic to shellfish, right, because it's not, you know, yeah, that's your truth.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, who knows?
I can write my own Wikipedia page and all of a sudden I'm a different human being than you're sitting with. Right.
Gotcha.
Now, right.
Yes. Yeah, man, it's stealing. You're right. It's a vampire. It's stealing away. It's stealing so much. It's stealing from us. Because earlier when we were talking about, I had not considered, and I'd never heard anyone say, it's what comes next on the playlist is the kind of music I like.
Right.
I'd never considered that. And that made me think of the beautiful moment my friend Emil, who you know, gave me a tape that had Daniel Johnston on it. And I'd never heard Daniel Johnston before.
I remember that moment also.
Holy shit. And I remember, because I didn't know what lo-fi was. I knew nothing about it. He gives me this tape. One, just the exchange of the tape with a new friend. A mysterious new friend who's given you this odd tape with Daniel Johnston scrawled on it. Then you go back to your dorm room, put the tape in the tape player, hit play. And my first thought was, oh, is Emil a Satanist? Because this music, I've never heard anything like this in my life, but it is so overpoweringly dark. It was rock and roll, EKG, you know that one? The Daniel Johnston on rock and roll, EGA or something?
I don't know.
Oh, that rock and roll, it saved my soul.
I don't know. Yeah.
Fuck, I'll play it for you.
Yeah.
But anyway, it was so overwhelmingly sweet. But not just because the music was incredible, but because this person had given it to me and there was a connection to this, to a being, and it was like magic happening.
Yeah.
What was the first moment you heard Daniel Johnston?
I can just remember being in the house that I grew up in the kitchen. I just remember this sense. There was a skylight and I remember listening to Hi, How Are You? It was a tape that some friends, you know, for some friends of mine had gotten maybe in Texas, because that's where you could get the tapes then.
Yeah.
And yeah, just being deeply, 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 deeply frightened also.
Yes.
I felt frightened because of the way it's like my reaction, you know, I was reacting to it and then reacting to my reaction. Like, I found that it was really, really captivating and really, but at the same time, so scary, you know?
Why do you think it's scary?
I don't know. I mean, I think it was probably partly scary because of this understanding that, you know, but I didn't know that he was necessarily crazy. I don't know. Like, it was just so scary. It was so scary because it was so beautiful, you know, I love that record so much, but I haven't listened to it in 30 years, I'm sure. And I probably know all the little clicks and pops because it has so many strange noises on it. But just, thinking, I don't know. I mean, also just, it's such a magical record.
Yeah, I don't
I don't know. It was I remember there was a Martin Scorsese short movie called American Boy. You ever see that?
No.
About a guy named Richard Prince, who was a professional roadie who plays a gun salesman and taxi driver.
Okay, sure.
And he was Neil Diamond's like tour manager or something like that. And the movie is just 45 minutes or an hour of kind of sitting in a house and in a hot tub. Martin Scorsese sitting with him, getting him to tell stories about his life. And that was similarly, like, for some reason, watching that, I was just full of this fear.
Yeah.
But it feels like it's kind of a there but for the grace of God fear.
Yes.
That's the fear.
I was about to say that. Yeah. Sacred fear.
Yeah.
Or that, I don't know where it is in the Bible. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And when you feel that kind of sacred, ecstatic fear in relation to art.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the most precious feelings because you are making contact. This is a real connection here.
Yeah.
And it means you're going to grow. It means like you've found the next breadcrumb in this.
Wow. Yeah. 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 Totally. Yeah. Cause it is kind of, that's a nice way to think of it as that kind of fear that you feel first day of school.
Yes.
Right. Where you just think, I know right now. Yeah, it's like I know right this moment. I know without a doubt that I am about to become somebody else.
Yes.
And it's scary as hell. Yeah, that's cool. Because I was thinking that I was scared, like, you know, some weird way, scared of, but like I say, I didn't know necessarily that Daniel Johnston was crazy the first time I heard it, but scared of opening that door into somebody's, you know, into this incredibly vulnerable and beautiful and seductive space. Where is it going to take me? But maybe it's just the first day of school.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's going to be okay. But it's just scary because you're just like, I woke up this morning, I got up, I tied my shoes, I ate my cereal. And tomorrow when I do that, I'm going to be a different person.
Yeah.
And I was happy this morning. There's nothing wrong with it, but it's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My friend Mitch and I were talking about this. He's the idea of, and again, you know, just for a thought experiment, who knows if this is real or not, but that we, so he was telling me, and he's way better at describing these things than I am at describing them, but I think it's a Greek concept, this idea that you leave, that you give, when, so before you come to life, before you wake up into this incarnation, you give yourself these moments in the incarnation, which are moments where everything is going to change. And uh-huh. That's crisis. Uh-huh. And so it's almost as though at some point in another dimension, you arranged with whatever the thing is that's making this thing happen. Give me Daniel Johnston in the kitchen. Let me have it there. A little clue.
Yeah.
A little clue in the incarnational cycle. Hey, check this out. This is something special. And maybe that's what that fear is yeah. that, oh my God, wait, I'm almost remembering something here.
Yeah.
But you don't quite know what it is.
Yeah.
It's like that movie Memento.
It's definitely, it's a recognition thing for sure. And that's the frightening part about it is you're recognizing something that you feel like you've never seen. I mean, I'd never heard anything like that before, but I was recognizing something.
Yeah.
That's really scary. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Memento. It's like, but I was too young to have even been able to write the notes to myself on the Polaroid photos.
Yes.
Right? Like now I can sort of do that. I can sort of have a sensation and say, okay, I recognize this fear even. And that's the note that you've written on the photo,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
But then I had not done that. I had no idea what was going on. It was just like this, yeah, reaching from one reality or one place in time or something into another fully.
Burning bush. It's a burning bush. And, yeah. and this burning bush, and I love that in the Bible where the burning bush happens, because I think the voice of the Lord says something along the lines of, take off your shoes because you are standing on holy ground. And it's so beautiful. And it's like that idea of like, you know what? The next time I get that feeling, please God, let me have it at least a few more times in this life.
Yeah.
I'm popping my shoes off.
Because, oh yeah. That's a good, yeah.
You know, just.
That's, wow. Yeah. How will you remember to do that?
You just got to do it. You'll remember. Just pop your shoes off. And
but
like,
those moments are pretty overwhelming.
When was the last time you had a moment like that?
Well, it's funny to think, I was just thinking like about after saying the first day of school thing, and this, I think maybe oftentimes this time of year, there's a gnawing dread.
Mm.
And this year I was thinking, trying to think, well, where does that come from? Is it because I would be going back to school, you know, age 5 through 19 or 20, whenever I gave up those endeavors, you know? Is that why I just sort of, you know, getting cool? And there's a little bit of fear that's coming too.
Yeah.
Why is that? Yeah. So I don't know. Or is it unrelated to that? And with my wife right now in life, we're about to turn some huge corners, which I'm sure is also the case. And is that the...
What corners?
I mean, just things, you know.
Right.
Just,
yeah, sure.
We'll be married for a year in a few weeks, you know.
Wow.
And we will just continue to do things with each other that make our life together more of, you know, a big thing.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
So is it, it's like you're sensing this continued solidification of this intense lifelong relationship happening.
And we know, you know, we just sold my mom's house a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
She only lived there for the last 9 or 10 years, something like that. But it was because she just moved into a nursing home. She's in late Alzheimer's, right? Mm. So she'll be gone soon.
Yeah.
And it's not having any previous experience with Alzheimer's or with losing a mother soon, you know, it's been coming for over 10 years now.
Long time.
But now, you know, now because we made this big move and, you know, I'll never, you know, there were toy boxes that maybe grandkids have played with and we thought might play with in the future. Those toy boxes are gone because we finally cleaned out the basement.
Yep.
You know, something, yeah, the encyclopedias that we grew up with as kids, they're gone forever now.
Yep.
So it was a big thing. And then the next thing is that she will go.
Yes.
So maybe it's just that, you know, and just knowing like that I know that I'm in the middle of a big step. And so there's bit of fear that's mixed with some, you know, it feels more like fear, like the first time listening to Hi, How Are You? There was only a little bit of joy, but mostly it was fear.
Yes.
You know, and now there's a little more joy, like transition. You understand that there's a reason that there's joy that comes with transition as well.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, and I think that joy, a lot of people, that joy, they feel guilty about that joy because in the midst of that kind of transition, you think, well, how could I be feeling any kind of joy at all? This is my mom transitioning and I can't, but it is joyful. And until you've experienced it, it's impossible to understand what that joy is like and what that joy feels like. And this is, you know, Ram Dass talks about this and Roshi Joan Halifax talks about this. Someone who's on the show, and they say, if you really want to understand truth, sit with a dying person.
Right.
And it's very hard to come up with something more pure and real. And when that dying person is your mother,
yeah,
and you're seeing this transformation happen to the being that whose breast you suckled on.
Right.
Now you're learning the way the universe is for real. You are seeing deep into the gears of the universe. And that is sometimes I think your mother gives you two massive gifts.
Mm-hmm.
Your life.
Right.
And the gift of watching them die. And these are two very, very powerful things. Obviously the first, but the second one, whoa, you don't.
And indeed. Yeah. It's the silver lining is that it's an awesome gift. That's the silver lining.
Yeah, but man, I mean, you know, I can remember after my mom passed, I got lucky. I got to go. I went to Ram Dass's house and I was sitting with him and the Zen Roshi. And man, you get broken open. Like you get blasted open. And I'm sitting there just like with these two, I don't want to throw around the word saint or whatever you want to call it, but these are people who've spent their whole lives, you know, in the practice. And Roshi Joan Halifax said this thing to me, which is, a window is opened for you right now. There's a window that is open when your mom dies.
Right.
And she said, it will shut.
Right.
And she said, so really be in this moment, because you only get it once. You only get that once.
An insane thing about, or is that this, like with my mom, the window's in one way or another been open for a long time. So it's going to be weird when it's, because I know that it will close, but it gets weirder every day the longer it goes on. You know, now that it is a little over a decade, that's a long time.
You know,
that's a serious portion of life right there.
Yes.
But I also know the whole time that it resembles, sometimes it resembles whatever, normalcy or reality or something like that. But the whole time, it still is always this open window that will close.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes my biggest fear is like to go before she does. Cause I just think like, no, I need a month after she's gone, you know,
yeah.
I need at least a month. I'd love 30 or 40 years, but I would take a month. You know, I want 30 or 40 years to recognize this time as a window. Right.
Oh yeah, man.
Cause it's not, you know, our dad was like, one day there, next day gone.
Yeah.
That's like a window where you lose something big.
Yeah.
And it just pops open and then maybe gradually closes, but it does close.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
But you're the shadow you've been enduring, which is the shadow of someone with a terminal prognosis.
Yeah.
There is a shadow on everything. So when my mom, you remember the diagnosis? You remember the first time they tell you?
Yeah.
You remember that moment on the phone? And then the strange clock starts ticking. And then you go through all the phases and you pray. And you at least you imagine, can I send my soul to her at night? Sometimes you would think, oh, I'll send my soul to her at night.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it will heal her in some way. And you start thinking, there, perhaps she's making it up. Maybe it's not real. The doctor's crazy. This can't be real.
Mm-hmm.
But it's real, man. And then so you forget it. As time passes, you have a dying mother. And so as time passes, you'll have these moments where you forget that your mother is dying. And then maybe you're high, maybe you're experiencing a great meal, then suddenly your mind will go and zoom back into the reality of this condition that has afflicted this person who was the very first woman you contacted in the material universe.
Right.
And so that's a shadow.
Yeah.
And when that shadow lifts a little bit, you're right. It's definitely worth staying alive.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. Yeah. I mean, you know, I was like, okay, I'm going to wear my seatbelt right now just because.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
That would suck so hard.
Yeah, but, well, you know, the other thing that you get that's maybe, this is a little woo-woo on my part, and I think it's the thing that is really tough to understand if it hasn't happened to you. You get your mom back because suddenly.
Oh, right, right. Yeah, that's what I mean. I you know, this, and it's like different things for myself and my wife that, you know, that we try to figure out. What's okay to talk about, what's not okay to talk about, right?
Sure.
And I think both of us try to err on, more and more try to err on talking about some things, you know? So, for example, you know, I think sometimes about my mom's funeral.
Yeah.
And at this point, you know, I kind of don't give a shit. You know, I really don't. Right. It's just like, for most of the people that she knows, it's already happened. You know, most of her friends, it's already happened.
Yes.
You know, a long time ago. But maybe a nice thing to do will be to ask some of her friends to come and reintroduce me to my mom.
Oh.
You know, like to talk about her to all of us. But yeah, to have that be what it's about. Like to maybe even say, okay, we're having mom's funeral and it's 2007. You know, it's not 2017, it's 2000 or 2018 or whenever it's going to happen, but it's 2007, okay? Get back there or not even, just talk to us about childhood, just remind us and have that be the purpose of the, cuz a traditional, for somebody with Alzheimer's, a traditional funeral is kind of like, it's not the right ritual.
Huh? Because you're saying why? Because it's been so long. So because their personality has dissolved.
Yeah, essentially their personality has dissolved. Yeah, and it's been, they're occupying a physical space that is unlike the person that.
Right.
You know, the reason I sit with her now is not because of who she was is now necessarily, as
right.
Of course it's who she was before.
Yeah, I gotcha.
And I always think of her as who she was before, as, you know, this is, that is who she is now. But there's a lot of people, you know, who care for her now, who never knew her before, who only know this now person. And that's a different
thing. Man, when I did some volunteer work at a hospice a long time ago, wasn't ready for it. And I sat with a woman who had, was late stage Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
And she, so, and because it's so very difficult for the family.
Right.
That it's easier for a person who doesn't know them to sit with them than it is for a person who knew them to sit with them. So the family sometimes will not show up because it's like, to be there is so emotionally, incredibly emotionally difficult. When my mom was dying of breast cancer in the final days, she was in bed and was asleep. And it was, I don't want to talk about it now. It was so overwhelming. So to go through that for a very long time.
And that was a combination probably of painkillers as well as the sickness that kept you from being able to have
that's
a communication with her. Yeah,
that's right. That's
a connection with her.
Yeah, that's what it was. So, but I remember this. Anyway, what I wanted to say is when I was with this woman, and she took me into her room and pointed to a picture of her family. And so I guess what I'm saying is, like, and this is something Ram Dass talks about. Yes, personality gone. But when you're sitting with your mother, the thing behind the personality is there.
Yeah.
And that's who you're sitting with.
Yeah. And there is no way, you know, I know that because of the way that this disease works, you know, in the ways that we don't understand, there's no determining anything. There's no determining any, you know, for sure, any what's gone, what isn't gone.
Right.
Well,
that's, and what they say, all you can do,
you know that a lot of things are gone, but you don't know exactly what, and you never will know.
Yeah. All you can do is be in the moment with them.
Yeah.
And the way they told me is become a loving rock, which is something that they can push off of, assuming there's a thing that can be pushed off, and a thing that they can hold on to if they need to. And that's sort of what you're doing.
Yeah.
Wow, man. You are this thing that you're in right now.
It's gone on so long that it's, you know, one book that I read, I don't even remember which one, you know, someone said, you know, asking somebody about their grief is like, you know, asking an octopus to tell you about his experience with water.
Yes, that's right.
And it, you know, and it's, but not to just to say grief, but just to, you know, someone will say, well, how's your mom? And I try to think, what do I say? She's, you know, I'll say, because if I saw her, you know, I saw her yesterday, she smiled at one point. So I'll say, you know, still smiling.
Yes.
Just because, you know, what else are you going to say? Like,
what can you say?
She's not moving. She's not speaking. She's, you know, but that's not what they're asking.
No. Well, they don't know what they're asking.
Yeah.
They're just trying to be polite.
Yeah.
They don't know what they're asking.
Yeah. They're trying to be polite, and they kind of, yeah. There's not a better question.
If you've gone through a mother dying, the odds are pretty good if you know someone's mom is dying.
Yeah.
You're not going to go, how's your mom? Because
you go,
oh yeah, I know you a little bit.
Yeah.
I know that. And that's all you can do.
Yeah. You just go hang out with, you know, that's, you go hang out with them, right? Sit in.
Yeah.
Anybody.
Yeah. Yeah. You just hang out and be in the moment, because that's pretty much it.
Bring them a sandwich.
Yeah. That is the best, actually. Sandwiches and just like. Yeah, just be there and know there's another kind of birth, because what you're doing is you're giving your mom, you're the midwife to your mom's birth into a new thing that's a transformation. And I failed at that, man. I didn't, what you're doing, I think people forget, or how what you're doing is such a sweet thing. Whereas I didn't, I wasn't with, I've had tremendous feelings of guilt because I don't feel like I was good enough in those moments, in the last moments with my mom, because it was going on so long. I ended up having to go on tour. Uh-huh. And it was just like,
yeah, yeah.
It was, and it's like what you're, so I guess what I'm saying is, as someone who I think kind of stumbled in that very important place, you're not stumbling. The thing you're doing is really like the, it's a beautiful thing. You're doing a, whereas I kind of cannonballed, you're doing a nice dive, and that's a sweet thing that you're doing.
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, like when you, at the beginning of the conversation, you talked about the serving thing, and I talked about some people don't have to do that.
Yeah,
you know, where,
huh? Yeah,
yeah. It would be, you know, potentially would, you know, like sometimes, you know, I think sometimes, I don't think so, but like, are Dick Cheney and Mitch McConnell like happier people because they don't have a conscience than I am, or than you are?
Yeah.
Or, but just thinking, you know, also would it be better to not?
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No,
I mean, I find also, yeah.
It's, I guess.
It's, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, I don't know. It like I said, but it is a, but it's always a, it always, it's not inherently good. It's only good because I'm learning things from it, right? Right. I mean, if I'm just giving something to her, she, you know, that's a really weird thing. You know, that's a really weird thing. It's like to serve somebody. It's a strange, you know, to serve some, like the whole organization that is hospice that we call,
yeah,
we call it Hospice in Louisville for some reason, or in Kentucky, but it's hospice. Yeah. This whole thing that can, what is it about? It's, I think it's rad. Like the people, I mean, just the idea of respecting age, respecting amazing. Death, you know, why isn't it, you know, why are people why are we losing elderly populations because people mostly to belief, like people don't want to believe anymore that they're getting old. So we're, you know, we're not just losing a connection with the past and losing a connection with aging and ourselves. Part of it is because people don't even, you know, I am, you know, 80 years old, but I'm going to continue to pretend that I'm not. Therefore you will never have a relationship with an older person.
Wow.
Because I'm denying that I'm an older person, you know?
Wow. Right. Yes. Oh, wow.
Right.
Yes.
Like so many older people, you think like they're fucking dressed like whatever, they're dressed like they're 20 and,
yeah.
And then they've busted their face in a thousand ways and they're using hip jargon, and that means I don't get to have any old people in my life.
You don't get the traditional relationship with the elders that used to be so important.
That used to be so important.
Yeah.
And not just because of a connection to the past, but because it prepares you a little bit.
Oh, yeah. And gives them a purpose. It gives them a real purpose.
But that's projecting, you know, like to some, yeah, I'm sure that some old folks appreciate things and some old folks are like, what an idiot, yeah. You know? Yeah, yeah. Sure. I'll, you know, thanks for the cupcake, you idiot. You know, like I've lived this long. I don't need a cupcake.
I'll tell you, one of the people I sat with when I was volunteering for hospice, this woman was bedridden. She was, I don't remember her. She was a Hollywood, she'd been in a lot of movies and she was beautiful. She had pictures all over the wall of herself. Oh my God, this beautiful, beautiful being. She's laying in bed. I was only there once because I just had this little job. I'd run errands and stuff. And I came in, I said, she's laying there. And yeah, we have this idea that they're all going to be ethereal beings. I say to her, how are you feeling? And she looks at me and she goes, how does it look?
Yeah.
You know, there's no sacred moment of like, I'm releasing my body. It's just like, what do you think, asshole?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm dying, motherfucker.
Or a guy at my mom's nursing home, you know, you like it here? And he's like, eh, it is what it is.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, that.
But he's kind of, you know, he wasn't complaining. You know, he was like, if you're asking me to say this is a really nice place, I can't get those words out of my mouth.
Right.
But I'm fine. It's totally fine.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is one of the things they teach you in hospice is people die as they've lived. Have you ever heard that before?
Oh, right.
So the pattern. The pattern,
I haven't heard that, but that makes sense. Yeah.
So it's like kind of like the cycle of action in your life. When you're approaching death, if that cycle will just happen with more frequency as you get closer to death.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So you can almost, from the way that you're living now, kind of figure out probably how you're going to die if you have, like, time to die. And this is sort of like a lot of the reasons people say meditation is good or any kind of spiritual practice, because you're trying to break those cyclical like modalities that are negative, so that when you are finally approaching death,
yeah,
you can like enter into it with this open mind, and also the people around you, you won't afflict them as some people do when they're dying. You're not going to run a lot of crazy games on them or do some kind of weird shit, which can happen.
Right.
And so you gracefully exit the universe, which is a pretty amazing gift to give people.
Yeah, exit or transition or whatever happens.
Transition is the right word for it. It's not
necessarily exiting the universe. Well, we don't know, right?
Yeah. Where would you go? If you're exiting the universe, where would you go? I mean, you need a bigger universe, right? If there's a exit, there must be some other... I mean, that'd be amazing to exit the universe for a second, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I don't... Yeah.
That's a funny way to end the podcast. Well,
not with a bang, but with a whisper.
With a wisp, with an egg. Yeah, I don't know. You are amazing, and I am so honored to get to spend this little bit of time with you. And
I'm honored to host you here, to give you a good night's sleep.
Thank
like
you.
That is a huge reward for me. Like, you know, in getting to hear you talk in different ways, you know, over the years, and experience you in different ways. To think like, you know, one of the like, I like making music, of course, but I love also, like, being able to help you get a good night's sleep.
Well,
thank you. So that was awesome, so I appreciate it.
Thank you. This is a sweet place. You are truly a Southern gentleman and a hospitable human being.
Having the dogs here is great.
Thank you.
Your dogs.
And, yeah, I love you, and I hope that we continue to communicate.
I hope so, too.
Hare Krishna. Thank you, Will.
Thank you so much for listening, my sweet friends. That was Will Oldham. All the links you need to find Will are going to be at DuncanTrussell.com. Thank you for subscribing to us at patreon.com/DTFH. And much thanks to Squarespace for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a nice review. And I will see you very soon with a conversation with Wayne Coyne from the Flaming Lips. Thanks for listening, pals. Hare Krishna.